League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
You're listening to The Boss and the Gloss on SB Nation Radio.
People say I am the best boss.
You can find us on Twitter at SB Nation Radio and call in at 1-800-777-2907. Here's David Gao and Carla Dawson.
No mountain high enough for the Monday Night Delight. Carla Dawson, welcome in.
Welcome. It's so good to be back.
It is great to be back, and what a great weekend to come out of and talk sports.
Oh, my gosh. Never a dull moment.
No,
loved it.
I mean, the college football landscape shaken up radically. NFL, all kinds of action on and off the field, and we'll get to all those topics coming up.
Even the NBA kicking up some good dirt.
So. Even the NBA.
And baseball is trying to end, and it just won't. So,
no, well,
got awards and all kinds of things.
Big awards, and we can debrief those. Allison Footer from MLB.com will join us later this hour to talk some MLB. Monday Night Football about to get underway. We have the Panthers and the Dolphins playing tonight in a pretty good matchup, a matchup that really, really matters for these two teams.
Well, you never know what Carolina team you're going to see.
No, you don't.
A lot of peaks and valleys so far this season, but I'm rooting for the Panthers.
Well, you're with the boss and the gloss, and actually, since I am the boss, I'm going to, we'll make a job offer to you.
Oh, good. It's better than the alternative, right?
Well, that's right. You've been welcomed in again, but this is a bigger opportunity. This is not just Monday nights here.
All right.
Let me offer you the terms. All right. First of all, guaranteed contract for the next 7 years through 2024. We will pay unless you do something really egregious.
Oh, good. You're going to wait till my 30th birthday.
Well, excellent. Wait till your 30th.
Love it.
So we're going out to the 24-year, $50 million annually.
I'll think on that, sure.
Think about that. It's a good money. Mm-hmm. A lifetime use of a private jet, and then lifetime health insurance for your entire family. Are you in? I mean, that's the most I can offer.
How many jets are you offering? Is it lifetime of one jet, or do I get two? Because I'm assuming my family will grow over the, you know, the span.
Are you negotiating here?
I think I need to.
All right. There are the terms. They're on the table. When we come back, those are the whispers or the rumors of the terms for Roger Goodell. Carla Dawson, I think, will accept them.
I'm thinking I'm going to take it.
We'll see, in fact, if Roger Goodell will be taking that deal amidst other strife and drama with Jerry Jones.
And this is the truth. You are the best boss in the world.
Thank you very much. Whether I offer you $50 million or not.
Absolutely.
All right. When we come back, we'll take a deep dive into the NFL deliberations, Roger Goodell, Jerry Jones, and all the games of this past weekend. You are listening to The Boss and the Gloss on SB Nation Radio.
The Boss and the Gloss continues now on SB Nation Radio with David Gao and Carla Dawson.
So the good news is I, the boss, have offered Carla a job at $50 million, lifetime use of a private jet, and lifetime health insurance for her family. And she has said,
yes.
Yes.
I accept.
She's in. But Roger Goodell has been rumored to be offered that job. And apparently Jerry Jones is not happy that the compensation committee has talked to Goodell about that kind of an extension. It is an over-the-top, really generous extension, and Goodell would live happily ever after with those kind of economic terms. Jones is now, well, he has threatened to sue the league to stop this deal, and it sure seems that there's more than compensation at stake. Jones is unhappy with Goodell about all of the Ezekiel Elliott dilemma.
Absolutely. You know, I think it's the timing for Jerry Jones to come forward now is a little bit tricky because in May, when these negotiations started with Roger Goodell's contract, everyone voted, yes, we'll go through with it, including Jerry Jones. And so it's just a little bit tricky that now that we're a couple months later and Ezekiel Elliott is, in fact, the injunction for his suspension was not lifted. Now Jones doesn't like it because here's the thing. The owners all agreed, you know, I'm a CBA junkie. And they all agreed to those terms that Roger Goodell is judge, jury, and executioner. And that he has these. So Jerry Jones was on that side. He was one of those owners that did agree to that. You have to support the guy that you put there. And he is the lone voice that's coming out against him right now, which I think is interesting. So the other owners right now are asking him, they're advising him not to go ahead with the suit.
Yeah. I think rational minds will prevail, although can never say, but that eventually, well, the Jones won't go through with it, that he really didn't have a legal case to stop the compensation committee from extending a deal to Roger Goodell.
And maybe he's hoping to get traction by coming out like this.
In my mind, there's a different question on the table. One question, and I think you just answered it well, is what are Jerry Jones's motivations? I think he is unhappy with the judge and jury and the implications that's meant for the Cowboys and Elliott getting suspended. But the different question I want to ask is, does Roger Goodell, does his record, does it warrant that kind of a deal, an extension for another 7 years, $50 million, lifetime use of a jet? Has he been that good of a commissioner for the NFL?
I think it's a great question that you're asking, and I think it can be answered in a number of ways. Has he been perfect? No. Has any other commissioner made the revenue that has happened under his watch? No. And that's to the tune of $14 billion. That's billion with a B. And those 32 owners are pretty happy with $14 billion in revenue. So he is working for them. And as far as monies go, he's doing a great job. Now, if you talk to Robert Kraft and you talk to Jerry Jones, who have player issues, the Deflategate situation, the Ezekiel Elliott domestic violence situation, you would say, no, he's not doing a great job. He's also not good about getting in front of issues, which we've seen with Ray Rice, with the anthem, and most recently this past weekend is the concussion issue. So, no, he is not perfect by any means. And if you look at his salary, that's currently, I don't know, in the 30 millions, I think 38 million, as a percentage of a $14 billion business, that's probably pretty normal, which is weird to say.
You are a CBA junkie, but in this case, an employee contract junkie, yes.
Right.
But you're right. That is a small piece of the total NFL pie.
But it's, you know, it's a tricky thing. No, I would, we were talked about this earlier, David, is he's booed mercilessly at every pick of the draft, well, or every single day of the draft.
And somehow that's become normal, that the commissioner of a league would be booed by the fans of the league. This is what Goodell has brought upon us. And my gripe with Goodell and my question of the year, whether he's really deserving of it, is at least twofold most recently. I can set aside Ezekiel Elliott and Tom Brady, and we're actually going to hear from players later today who are very, very unhappy about Thursday Night Football. Mm-hmm. But your point about that, there's a lot of money for Thursday Night Football. But the two issues where I feel he really needs to take more leadership on, the national anthem, all the protests, all the drama around that, the ratings drops, the comments from Papa John's, all of that. Goodell has been somewhat quiet. Where is the leadership on the national anthem story? Where was he? Why didn't he stand up and say, look, as the representative, as the leader of the National Football League, I want to say that we acknowledge there's a whole history of atrocities and grievances and difficulties for people of the African-American race. That is real. At the same time,
this is a league that is 80% African-American.
It's a league that cares deeply about and is committed to the plight of African-Americans in this country. At the same time, we are a league that loves our country, that honors our veterans, and we want to find a way to bring these two things together, to love our country and take note of the challenge of being an African-American in this country. He just disappeared. He didn't say a word about it. He didn't stand up and say, we have to be bigger than the either-or debate that came out. The either-or debate was, well, you're either with the soldiers and the country, or you're with the African-Americans who have been dealt a difficult hand. It's either or. That's what the message that came out was. And he really didn't lead. He didn't unite. As far as I can tell, he was silent while different owners and players bickered behind the scenes.
I think that's exactly – you just hit the nail on the head. He didn't lead. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that he does lead. But he makes a ton of money. And sadly, in this world that we live in, money is everything. If you can win – and put dollars on the table, it trumps everything else. And unfortunately, we're seeing right now, it's hard to compare him as a commissioner to anybody else, because the situations that he's facing, this increased domestic violence, because now, because of social media and videos, we were able to see Ray Rice's situation. We're able to, you know things about Ezekiel Elliott. We're able to get in front of things because of social media, that people have things, you know, on video or Instagram or whatever it is. Other commissioners didn't have this challenge. So people have not, commissioners before him, Paul Tagliabue, people like that, did not have the issues that he is facing.
Duly noted. The other point I want to make, the other issue that I feel he's let the teams down and the players down, is this concussion issue.
No doubt.
And we can all say, well, whatever happened in the past. But this week, last 2 weeks, two marquee players, Russell Wilson, Jacoby Brissett, hit on the head, clearly suffering a problem.
Really bad hits.
And
too,
basically, right? The concussion protocol, the check on the sideline, they made a mockery of it on the field. There needs to be leadership on that issue. There should be a fine to somebody on that. If you're going to fine somebody for other issues, you're going to fine them for not following the concussion protocol. The league needs to be serious, and he needs to have leadership on that issue. It's a vital issue. You heard Bob Costas come out recently and say he didn't know about the future of football because it's a sport where everybody gets beat up and there's long-term implications to heads and bodies. If the NFL doesn't get out ahead of this, if he doesn't lead on this issue and he doesn't make Brissett and Wilson marquee guys accountable, that's bad for the whole league. He needs to get in front of it.
He does, absolutely. And I think with the concussion situation, with Russell Wilson specifically, that was Thursday night. And it wasn't until Sunday morning that it was the league is investigating the Seahawks' handling of the concussion protocol for Russell Wilson. Because you are supposed to, with the concussion protocol, say that 10 times fast, you know, come off the field, go to the locker room, be seen by your team physician, then be seen by an independent physician, and then you're, you know, eventually can go back in. Russell Wilson went into the sideline tent, and that may well suffice for the locker room. He missed one play, not one drive, not one quarter, one play. There is no way that those three steps in that concussion protocol happened during that time. But they needed Russell Wilson to win, and they won. And, you know, as a result, their soul is blackened for not dealing with this concussion protocol as they should. And you're right, you can't change the culture of concussion if the people at the top are not enforcing the things that they have in place.
Player safety, concussion protocol, protection of the head, that's got to be one of the top priorities of the commissioner of the NFL, and Goodell is not leading on it.
And he has the chance to get in front of it, and he's missed again.
Well, he now has a big chance because of these two star quarterbacks who violated the protocol. He ought to come down quite heavily on those teams and enforce it so he sets an example for later, because that's the game he's playing in other types of disciplinary action.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I don't know that who anybody would want to step into this job.
It's a monstrously tough job. You got all those bosses, all the other owners you've got to adjust to and work with are all billionaires, and then you've got to deal with lots of difficult disciplinary cases.
But, you know, he has brought, you know, football to Europe. He's brought football to Mexico. The revenue from that, the revenue from the TV, he has done amazing things on the business side. But I agree with you. There's nothing more important than the human condition, and he doesn't seem to be. He's talking the talk, but not walking the walk. So.
All right. That's the look at Roger Goodell. We're going to take a break. You're listening to The Boss and the Gloss. When we come back, we will get a special moment with Allison Footer of MLB.com. We'll get to hear her insights on the awards that were granted at MLB today and the retirement of Carlos Beltran. You're listening to The Boss and Gloss on SB Nation Radio.
The Boss and the Gloss continues now on SB Nation Radio with David Gao and Carla Dawson.
Welcome back. It's SB Nation Radio, The Boss and the Gloss. And joining us now on SB Nation Radio is Allison Footer of MLB.com. Allison, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
We're glad to have you and glad we can celebrate with you here in Houston.
Yeah, it's been a crazy week. It's hard to believe it's only been a little over a week since that parade. It was just a really long month. Now we're just kind of relaxing, and you just kind of take it all in. You look back on it, and you think, man, did that just happen? It's just nuts.
I agree. I still feel like I'm having an out-of-body experience. I can't believe it's real.
Yeah. I mean, for anybody who's been in Houston a long time, and the fact that they've never won one of these before, so it's new for all of us. But yeah, game seven, I was thinking, you know, it really didn't occur to me that they were going to win that World Series until like the sixth inning. And then I went, oh, okay, this is actually going to happen.
And you covered them for how many years, Allison?
I've been here about 20 years. I've covered them and I've worked for them. So, I've done a little bit of both. I don't cover them exclusively anymore, but I'm still based in Houston. But yeah, it's been, I think 21 seasons. So, long time.
We're talking to Allison Footer of MLB.com and a longstanding follower of the Astros. You know, it's sort of interesting to look back on this season. When did you get conviction that this team was special?
I mean, really pretty early on. They had the lineup was just insane. I wasn't that impressed with the starting rotation, but to get through a six-month baseball season, they had enough, certainly, the division being what it is. They were so far superior to any other team in the division that I knew that that winning the division was not going to be a challenge at all, and it wasn't. And, you know, look how many injuries they had throughout the season, and they're just so deep in so many different areas that even the injuries and just the fact that there was not that much competition in the AL West. So, you know, very early on. I mean, if you think about George Springer being moved into the leadoff spot the end of May mm-hmm. in 2016. I mean, and they've not been bad since then. So they fell on their faces to start that season, and then they moved him up, and they've been, like, dominant ever since. And so I think we're all pretty much expecting, with no holes in the lineup anymore, we were pretty much expecting them to run away with that division.
And Allison, thinking about that seven-game World Series, which is like the cardiac arrest series, I call it, what do you think was the most, with the Dodgers, the final World Series, what was the most pivotal moments? What kind of was switched over for you that you thought, this is what did it, or this is what's going to do it?
I don't know that there was like a specific moment. I mean, I really went into the World Series thinking the Dodgers were probably going to win it in about five. That was my prediction, and it wasn't so much a knock on the Astros as a whole as it was on the bullpen. So when you follow baseball for a long time and you certainly, you know, watch every inning of every postseason, it's a general rule of thumb that it's the bullpens that get you there to the end. And the Dodgers just had a good bullpen and the Astros didn't. And so I thought, you know, they're both looking kind of tired, but the Dodgers certainly, you know, they have good relievers that are tired, and the Astros have just kind of mediocre relievers that are tired. And so I really thought that was going to be the difference. And so I guess one of the big turning points was probably game two when Marwin hit that home run.
Mm-hmm. That was my turning point. Yep. That's exactly what I thought it was.
Yeah, and it was kind of like, oh, wow, they snuck away with a win here in Los Angeles, which it just wasn't looking that way for most of that game. So you're like, they're going to go home 0-2. And I think we can all predict how this thing is going to turn out. So I think that was, to do it off of Kenley Jansen and to do it on their home field, on Dodgers home field. And I think that just gave them some confidence because their offense had been sputtering so much up until then. And so I think that was really the pivotal moment. But again, I still didn't think that it was going to go in the Astros' favor. And just to go back even further, I mean, the real pivotal moment for me was when the Indians lost to the Yankees, and I thought the Astros are now the favorite, and the reason is because the Indians had seen Justin Verlander so much being a Tiger mm-hmm. in their division, and he had like almost a 5 ERA against the Indians since 2014. I mean, he wasn't fooling anybody, and I realized that he turned it up a notch and he became like otherworldly for like, you know, since he joined the Astros. And so, and that's what elite pitchers do. When it's like down the stretch and in the postseason. So I'm not saying he wouldn't have pitched well, but I really felt like that was going to be a huge factor. I didn't think they were going to get past the Indians because of that. And so when the Indians got bounced, I was like, oh man, okay, now they're on their way. So to me, that is the thing that stands out more than anything the entire month of October.
We're talking to Allison Footer, a writer for MLB.com. So Allison, Carlos Beltran announcing his retirement today. What did he mean to the Astros? And then put a footnote on his career. Is he a Hall of Famer to you?
Yeah, I think he's a Hall of Famer. I think that, studying his numbers kind of over this past season when he rejoined the Astros and it looked like this might be his last year. He turned 40 in April. There was a lot made of that. Um, and, And, yeah, I mean, you look at him among, like, the best switch hitters. You know, he's right up there. He's got definitely all the offensive numbers. He was a five-tool player. I realize that he wasn't that toward the end of his career, but an elite five-tool player throughout. And he kind of checks all the boxes. I mean, he's not, you know, there'll be some dissension on that. He won't be a first ballot. I think that's, you know, that's something that it just gets ridiculous, kind of, oh, he's not a first ballot Hall of Famer, so he'll get on the third ballot, and that somehow legitimizes the process. But, yes, I do believe that he will be in the Hall of Fame someday. I don't think he's going to have to wait that long either. I really do. I think that a lot of the kind of the new age analytic minded voters that have come on in the past few years definitely think he is. And I think there's enough kind of old school people that also just look at like the raw data. I think everybody would come to the same conclusion that he's a Hall of Famer.
I agree, Allison. And of course, at the end of every baseball season, sometimes before the end, there's lots of manager changes. And, you know, looking at specifically the ones that surprised me the most were the Washington Nationals with getting rid of Dusty Baker and the Yankees with Joe Girardi. Do you think that in both those situations with Baker and Girardi, did they need to go?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Dusty thing didn't surprise me because that's the Nationals, right? They're just
right.
kind of dysfunctional
mm-hmm.
people, and they don't.
Seven managers in 12 seasons or something crazy.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if he's not what you're looking for, then you shouldn't have hired him. I mean, he hasn't changed at all. The team did very well. Of course, they didn't advance beyond the division series. They haven't ever done that, so it's not just Dusty's fault. And so they just don't put that much, I guess, value kind of in the manager's position when you're talking about dollars. And it just, you know, I kind of felt like, well, Dusty really doesn't have a lot of leverage because nobody else is going to hire him. I mean, you know, these other teams are going for the younger, analytically minded. And so does Dusty really have that much leverage? So the Nationals could probably sign him to a multi-year deal for not that much money. But the Nationals being the Nationals, you know, that came as, like, no shock at all. It was so bizarre that, like, all of these managers of these playoff teams get fired. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're a playoff team. John Farrell gets fired,
right.
Joe Girardi, Dusty Baker. I mean, it was so ridiculous. And then, you know, from the Yankee standpoint, I mean, it just sounded like, I mean, the way everybody was writing and talking leading up to that, that it was going to be Joe's decision if he wanted to come back. And he had been talking about maybe not wanting to continue managing. And then, boom, like the off day when we were in between games 2 and 3 in the World Series, he's gone. And so, yeah, I mean, that one, I think, surprised. I think that was probably the biggest surprise of all of the managerial firing. But I think it's all, I think it's just all silliness when you're talking about managers that, like, you know, went deep into October with their teams, or even just like John Farrell, who just went, you know, I mean, they lost the division series because they were the, like, inferior team. The Red Sox could not match up with the Astros and whatever, you know, it's like general managers, they get the itch, they got to do something. So they do that.
Yeah, you're hired to get fired. And I
yes.
wonder with Joe Girardi, do you think he started out behind because he came after Joe Torre? I mean, he basically was not Joe Torre, who was so beloved in New York. And Girardi just has such a different style.
Yeah, I mean, he's been there 10 years, so I don't think that really was so much a factor. I think that as things have evolved, if you believe what you read, you know, Brian Cashman just felt like he was a little too intense. He wasn't connecting with the younger players. You know, there's always things mm-hmm. that go on that we don't know about, that I always defer to the people in charge when it comes to the reasonable people in charge. When they do have their reasons, you have to kind of say they know their personnel better than anyone. You know, we don't know what the relationship with Gary Sanchez was with Joe Girardi. We don't know how he was with Aaron Judge. We just don't know. And then, you know, Joe's also very intense, and mm-hmm. maybe Cashman felt that his being so tense during, you know, pivotal times in the postseason or down the stretch, maybe that was having an effect on the players. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's all different kinds of reasons, and maybe they just thought this would be a good time. You know, they just wanted to kind of start over, start new. But you know, Brian Cashman has been doing this long enough that I believe that he does things for good reasons.
That is Allison Footer of MLB.com. Allison, thanks so much for joining the Boston The Gloss. David and Carla here on SB Nation Radio. Always great insight from you. Thanks for joining us.
Okay. Thanks for having me on. Anytime.
So it's interesting to look at the offseason, which is what I would have loved to have asked her if we could have gotten to it. At least for the Astros, they need to shore up the mm-hmm. bullpen, and there might be a couple ways to do that. I don't know if Astros will open up the pocketbook for a Wade Davis. He'd be a heck of an addition.
Oh, gosh, he would be fantastic.
Other rumors, they'd go after and sign Arrieta and move McCullers to the bullpen. Lots of options. It'll be a fun offseason for the Astros and all of MLB to watch.
Yeah, and she was great. Loved having her insight.
When we come back, we're going to take a deeper dive into the NFL action over the weekend. We'll also give you an update on Monday Night Football with the Panthers and the Dolphins in Charlotte. You're listening to David and Carlo on SB Nation Radio.
The Boss and the Gloss continues now on SB Nation Radio with David Gao and Carla Dawson.
Well, we talked a little bit in the first segment about Jerry Jones versus Roger Goodell, the Cowboys off the field. Let's look at the Cowboys on the field. They fell to the Falcons yesterday.
Ooh, wow.
And the Falcons were reeling coming into that game. Now, it was at home. Falcons certainly have a lot of pieces, but the Cowboys didn't have the pieces they needed.
And Dallas came in with a three-game win streak that obviously ended yesterday. They only put 7 points on the board, which was tough. And you know what they've got coming up? They're going to see Philadelphia twice in Seattle, all that without Ezekiel Elliott.
Well, without Ezekiel Elliott and without now, it looks like, Sean Lee. And Lee, the linebacker of the Cowboys, has been instrumental in stopping the run. The Cowboys have been limiting opposing defenses to about 3 yards per carry when Lee's on the field and over 5 yards per carry when he's off the field. Lee suffered a hamstring injury yesterday. He's out likely for 2 to 3 weeks.
Yeah,
that's a
critical.
Huge setback for that defense.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but talk to me about your tackle, Tyron Smith.
That's not a happy
yesterday?
Topic. Yes, so Tyron Smith, it's sort of interesting. If you look at the Cowboys yesterday, at four positions.
This is David's team, by the way.
Well, I'm coming out of the closet here.
Du Bois.
But at four positions, running back Elliott, Tyron Smith, left tackle, Sean Lee, linebacker, and Dame Bailey, kicker. You have guys, four players who are probably in the top three or four guys at their position across the league, none of whom were able to play a full game yesterday. Lee had to leave. Tyron Smith did not play, at a groin injury. So this was a real setback. Four key guys off the field. Obviously, the offense didn't look the same without Elliott. And then Chaz Green filling in for Tyron Smith, left tackle. That was a debacle.
Okay, tell me about Chaz Green. He obviously had a very, very, very rough night, to say the least.
Had a rough night.
Sacked eight times yesterday. Thank you very little. Yikes.
I don't think I've seen a tackle play like that in a long time. I mean, that was eight sacks against Adrian Claiborne. Claiborne, it was disastrous. Look, Green is a third-round pick, about 3 years into the league. Cowboys thought he could be a good swing tackle for them, filling in at either right or left in the case of injury.
Is he an SEC guy?
I'm not sure.
Florida.
Okay, so he came out and just did not perform well. Mm. But before we go any further, let's take a break. We've got our stringer, our man on the ground, Ken Casey at Bank of America Stadium in Charlotte. Ken, how's the game developing?
Both teams have had the ball. Carolina kicked off. The Dolphins got the opening possession, got one first down, punted. Christian McCaffrey had a brief return. They got one first down. Carolina got one first down. McCaffrey took a screen pass, got first down, but Carolina has just punted. So Miami will have it first and 10 inside their own territory, looking at about their 11-yard line. For the Dolphins, they're 4-4. They've lost two straight. They get safety T.J. McDonald back from suspension. Jay Cutler, the Dolphins quarterback, has 7 touchdown passes in his last 8 quarters. For the Dolphins, 5 games decided by 6 points or less. For Carolina, they are the number one defense in the NFL. 9-6 on Monday Night Football, 6-3 at home. However, they are 0-2 against the Dolphins in this building. And Ryan Khalil, the Pro Bowl center for Carolina, is out again with a neck injury. No score from Bank of America Stadium between the Dolphins and Panthers. 8:58 to go first quarter.
That's Kevin Casey, our man on the ground in Charlotte. No score, Monday Night Football. And the Cowboys were low scoring. That was notable. Their offense has been scoring.
Low for them,
season low.
Points.
They've been scoring up at 30 points or more most games, and then to be shut down to 7. Really, that left tackle spot, as we said, was that Chaz Green just did not play. The notable thing to me was Chaz Green clearly was overmatched. He could not protect Prescott at all. What I was surprised is the Cowboys took so long or really didn't help out Green at all. Now, they replaced him with Byron Bell, pretty much the same result. Mm-hmm. But why didn't they put a tight end over there? Why didn't they double team and support Green? Clearly, that look, they would have left, they would have one less receiver out in the play, but that would have been better than having Prescott get sacked, Prescott having fumbles. It would have just been an entirely different game. They had to stop that pass rush, and they did nothing to adjust.
In Atlanta, the Cowboys made Atlanta look so good. They had lost 4 of 5 before coming into yesterday's game, and wow, made Adrian Claiborne look like a superstar. You know, he made $750,000 in incentives yesterday.
Well, 6 sacks in one game. A lot of players would be happy to get 6 sacks in a season.
Right, including Adrian prior to this game yesterday.
Crazy outcome.
So, you know, here's the rub for the Cowboys. This is Dak's team, and you got to protect your franchise. So they've got – I think that's on the coaches. I'm going to put it on the coaches. So
they need to make some adjustments.
Because they're not going to have Elliott for at least 4 games. And then there's a possibility after the hearing on December 1st they could get him back. But 6 maximum, but for sure 4, you're not going to see him.
So the Cowboys fall way behind the Eagles in the NFC East. The Falcons are alive at 5-4, just a couple games back from the Saints in the NFC South. So look out for the Falcons. They're still in it. I mean, they need to, they've obviously had that, well, we've talked about their Super Bowl hangover.
Mm-hmm. And they're so tired of hearing that.
I'm sure they are.
When you lose 4 or 5 and you weren't to the Super Bowl, you're going to hear that. So
now locally, the Texans were a bundle of disappointment yesterday. They're not the same team with Deshaun Watson. If ever you could see the impact of losing a starting quarterback, you've seen it with this rookie.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. You look at, so the average amount of points for the Texans with Savage, 10 points a game. With Watson, 34 points a game.
Amazing.
What more can you say about that? That's a 24-point differential. And we talked about this before the show, too, is that last week when Savage got his start after Deshaun Watson went down with his ACL injury, everyone was so excited because he threw his first NFL touchdown pass. I really don't find a reason to celebrate when this is your fourth year in the league and you have just thrown your first NFL touchdown pass.
Right.
I don't want to be overly harsh on him because he's a consummate he is an ultimate teammate.
No doubt.
The guys really like him. You know, he has been a professional. He has been nothing but pure class when he was benched week 1 at halftime against Jacksonville for Deshaun Watson. But it is now time to – we can't count on him. I don't know that the Texans have other options. But this is really disappointing, and it's really unfair to Tom Savage. He's not ready for this stage. Can you tell me otherwise? You can tell me I'm wrong. I'm okay with that.
I'm sorry, but everything we've seen does not look good. Interestingly, of course, at this point in the season, if you're a fan, you say, well, the Texans can lose out, and then we'll get a better draft pick. But the Texans have traded away their draft pick in order to get Watson. I guess what you can say if you're a Texans fan is relative to last year. Last year, the team...
There was no hope.
Didn't have a quarterback, and without a quarterback, there really was no direction.
Right.
Now, you know Watson will come back next year. We've gotten a taste of what Watson can do on the field. There is hope for the Texans.
There's, and I think that's what I would tell Texans fans is, hey, you know what? Just consider this season a wash because you've got your guy coming back next year. We know we have... They know they have found their franchise quarterback. But let's not discount what the Rams are doing. Oh, my goodness. Sean McVay has just turned that team around from the Jeff Fisher Rams, where Jared Goff didn't even dress out for his first game, his rookie season, to he's a superstar. He had 3 touchdowns, 0 interceptions yesterday, where Tom Savage had 4 turnovers, 2 interceptions, 2 fumbles. But I think that linebacker Alex Ogletree for the Rams said it best, and he said this about his own team, but this is what I would say would sum up the problem with the Texans. So Ogletree says, we have confidence in our offense. We knew that if we did our part on defense, then the offense would come together and play well, and they continue to show that every single week.
Mm.
Hello.
Yeah, Texas defense can't have that confidence in the Texas offense
they
at this
can't.
Moment.
The offense is inept, and the defense is exhausted. It was 9-7 Rams at the half, and our defense, the defense really held them very well, despite some big mistakes by the Texans, fumbles on a kickoff and everything. But the defense could not hold up.
So back to the Rams, what McVay has done is remarkable.
Remarkable.
To me, one of the prettiest offensive plays in NFL is not the long bomb, not a run, but a screen pass. Mm-hmm. When the linemen sort of drift out, they get in so front nice. There, the ball is caught well, and there's space, and the linemen start knocking down those D-backs like bowling ball over pins. And it, you see it, the Rams run that play very well. They ran it a couple
perfection.
Times. To perfection. And it's almost a piece of art when you see it executed really, really well.
Well, you look at the second half Rams, you know, it's all about adjustments. It's what you can do. The good ones make adjustments at halftime. Bill Belichick adjusted beautifully in the Super Bowl against the Falcons.
Yep.
Obviously, so did Sean McVay. He sees 9-7 leading the Texans at the half. The second half Rams come out, a sack on Savage, 6 more quarterback hits, and limits the Texans to 95 second half yards with no third down conversions. Zero. Mm. That is mastery of adjustment, and you've got to be able to do that at this level.
Okay, as much as the Rams are a pleasant upside mm-hmm. surprise, mm-hmm. on the inverse of that, the New York Giants, McAdoo and company, what is going on?
McAdoo?
McAdoo.
Goodness. I mean, you know what? They just gifted San Francisco the first win, so way to go 49ers, who probably didn't want to win at this point.
No, that's the battle for the first-round draft pick.
Absolutely, but I will say, the 49ers have managed, you know, with John Lynch and Kyle Shanahan, beautiful job in the draft this year. They have positioned themselves well. And the reason why it's okay that this is happening in San Francisco, that they are now 1-7, is that they have been very upfront. We're not going to win this year. Mm-hmm. Like, this is a building process. I mean, and to flip sports a little bit, you look at how Jeff Luno came in with the Houston Astros and said, okay, yeah, you just had a 100-plus loss season. This is my plan. We're not going to win this year, and we're probably not going to win next year. But just hold tight and look what we're looking at year three with the World Series. Same deal in San Francisco. They've got their process. They're drafting well. They're being smart. They're bringing in the right veterans, getting rid of the wrong veterans. It's going to take some time.
Well, and if Garoppolo is the quarterback of the future, they got him on the relative cheap. They get him at the top of the second round with the trade for New England. They'll get one of the top 3 or 4 picks this year, which they can use for a key player, maybe a Saquon Barkley, somebody at the top that really rounds out that offense.
Definitely, because if they wanted to win now, Garoppolo would be starting on Sundays, and he's not. So they're smartly just keeping him in the waiting and see what's going to happen. But the New York Giants, I am so sorry if you are a New York Giants fan. This is the saddest situation. It's I call them the I don't care Giants. There's no effort.
Mm-hmm.
There is no effort, including starting from the top down, Ben McAdoo. He is so uninspiring. I don't think he could get my dog to sit up. I don't know what he just is. And did you see his quote? He says, my guys need to be self-motivated. Everybody gets a paycheck this week. Bam. No, coaches are supposed to inspire. Yes, you're in the NFL. You should have that kind of, you know, get up and go.
Professionalism.
How about that? But they're dropping like flies in the injury bug, and they're realizing, what am I playing for? Well, the coach needs to tell them what they're playing for. This is a sad situation. Do you see anything that's going to help this Giants team?
Well, so no. I think right now the writing's on the wall. McAdoo will not be back. Giants will have one of the top picks in the draft. They're likely going to use it on a quarterback because this is the time to get one. Manning's at the tail end of his career. Right. This is going to be a team that undergoes sweeping changes in the offseason.
What would you change with the Giants? Besides everything, but specifically, what would you focus on?
Well, we'll get McAdoo out of there. Mm-hmm. Maybe Manning stays around another year, but you've
got to help a young quarterback.
You've got
maybe?
To draft a young quarterback and take advantage of being so high in the draft. And then later in the draft, they need help on the offensive line. That's probably the next big place to try to fill some gaps.
Boy, offensive linemen are going to have a heyday because there are so many offensive lines full of holes in the NFL this year. Crazy.
No doubt. No doubt the Texans need them. The Giants need some offensive linemen. It's a position of weakness across the NFL this time. So when we come back, we will take one last look at the NFL as we conclude the first hour of The Boss and the Gloss on SB Nation Radio.
The Boss and the Gloss continues now on SB Nation Radio with David Gao and Carla Dawson.
Welcome back. It's The Boss and the Gloss. And so the Monday night game, 0-0, Cam Newton versus Jay Cutler. Not an inspired matchup. Cam Newton, Mr. Inconsistency.
He really is. But this is a chance to show everybody differently on Monday Night Football. But I don't know. So far, we'll see.
Okay, we've covered a lot of NFL ground.
We need several more hours.
I know we do. But quickly, in the NFC East, who do you view as the class of the conference right now?
I've got to go with New Orleans.
Over the Eagles. You like the Saints.
I love what the Saints are doing. They started out 0-2.
Yep.
And they're now on a 7-game win streak. They've got not only an unbelievably stout defense, but this running back tandem of Kamara and Ingram is incredible. I love watching them week after week. Here's the moral of the story. You want to have a coach named Sean. Sean McVay with the Rams, Sean Payton with the Saints.
See wow. The insights that are possible. You're right.
I'll tell you. See, we girls, we think of things like this. So.
Sean is the name.
I mean, I'm really impressed.
Yeah,
with
and their right defense now. Is now rounded into form. They got the great corners playing very, very well. Sean Payton really hasn't had a good defense for most of his tenure in New Orleans. The Rob Ryan days are over. Thank goodness.
Oh, darn.
So the Saints defense is playing better, and they may well be the class of the NFC.
You know, and yesterday they had a franchise record 6 touchdowns.
Yep.
I mean, this is just, it's so much fun to watch them. But they've got a test coming, 3-game critical stretch with the Rams, Carolina, and the Falcons all coming up. So it's exciting. I love this part of the year.
Yep. No, absolutely. Those are good teams, and they'll be good matches. You know, when we come back, we're going to let the world's biggest Vikings fan, Chris Tubbs, who lights a candle every Vikings game and says a prayer. We're going to let you weigh in on why the Vikings should be considered the class of the NFC.
He did add a sign of the cross, too. I love it.
No, he's definitely
the man, the myth, the legend.
He'll pull any lever for his Vikings. So the Vikings, the Eagles, and the Saints thus far, the class of the NFC. Panthers trying to make a case tonight here on Monday Night Football. We'll take a look and keep you updated on that one, which is 0-0 as we speak. And again, the big tease, Chris Tubbs, and why the Vikings are the class of the NFC when we come back on The Boss and the Gloss. You're listening to SB Nation Radio.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.